This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In the past several decades across the South, state legislatures have considered measures to limit the rights and privileges of immigrant populations. In response, new coalitions have formed between traditional civil rights groups and immigrant rights organizations. These new groups have leveraged political power to affect change in states like Mississippi and Alabama. The alliance between Latino and African-American populations runs against popular perceptions of antagonism between Black and Latino groups. But for my next two guests, Black and Latino Coalition is a natural progression in the battle for civil rights. Hannah Brown is a sociology professor at Wake Forest University. Welcome, Hannah. Good to have you here.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Also with us is Jennifer Jones, a sociology professor at the University of Notre Dame. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you for having us.
They're both participants in a panel later today, part of Duke Law Conference, The Present and Future of Civil Rights Movements, Race and Reform in the 21st Century, in 21st Century America. So, Hannah, let's start off with this idea of Black and Latino coalitions. The thought that they should be exceptional, it is surprising to us. Tell us sort of where that idea came from.
Absolutely. Well, regardless of where we look in the United States today, whether it's the media or scholarly research or even public opinion research, what we generally see is reporting on Black-Latino conflict. That's sort of become the norm, and we have these conversations about intergroup relations. And our understanding of Blacks and Latinos as somehow inherently or naturally at odds comes from the fact that most of our experience with Black-Latino relations, or at least most of the public understanding, comes from specific encounters. So we hear about or think about things like the Rodney King riots, where there was conflict between Black and Latino communities, or we hear stories of gang warfare between Blacks and Latinos. And then from these specific cases, we draw broader conclusions, often along the lines of the fact that Blacks and Latinos have fundamentally different political interests, fundamentally different economic interests. They're often in competition for scarce resources. And so as a result, political coalitions are unlikely to arise. And so when Jen and I first started doing research on anti-immigrant laws and looking at states that have somehow managed to thwart the passage of anti-immigrant laws, we're really surprised to see that the movement behind these particular pushback has come from Black-Latino coalitions. And that's led us to look much more deeply at the extent to which Blacks and Latinos are collaborating in the political sphere today.
Let's talk first about the anti-immigrant efforts. Are they mostly in the South, or is that where you study? Jen, did you look at the legislation in the South and pushback there? Or is that because that's where most of the anti-immigrant legislation has been promoted?
So it's true that anti-immigrant legislation has been extremely popular in the South. So there have been a number of Southern states who have taken cues from states like Arizona and passed omnibus bills, states like Georgia, South Carolina, and Alabama. So we're seeing a lot of attention to immigration issues, in part because the South sort of as a region experienced massive demographic change all at the same time in the 1990s and early 2000s. So there was a lot of sort of legislative response on both sides in trying to figure out whether they wanted to engage in integrative policies or punitive ones. But generally speaking, it is certainly not the purview of the South to engage in anti-immigrant politics. We see this on the national stage, and then we see this in states, as I mentioned, like Arizona, as well as Indiana and other places in the Midwest. So really, I would call it more of a patchwork that we have different states who are taking different approaches, and they vary from location to location.
So tell us about the coalitions that you find. Maybe we can start as an example in Mississippi. Tell us what you found there.
Yeah, so we have found Mississippi to be one of the most extraordinary states in our collective imaginations. We often think about Mississippi as one of the most racist states or states that have one of the states has had the most difficult history around race relations. And what we found was that in Mississippi, there have been a number of efforts to pass punitive laws or anti-immigrant laws in the state. And nearly every single one of those laws has either died in committee or not made it through a full vote or was never passed. And so when we realized that this was happening at the same time that Jackson was being declared a sanctuary city, We were wondering what's happening in Mississippi that people are taking such a proactive stance on immigrant rights. And what we found when we started going down there and talking to people was that there was this really strong coalition of labor organizers, of religious organizers, of civil rights groups, both Black, Latino, and white, who were building this strong framework to push back against anti-immigrant policies and also put forward integrative policies in their place.
This is interesting, Hannah, because it suggests the newer organizations, immigrant rights groups, would be very new organizations, and they're not creating coalitions out of whole cloth. They're connecting with long-standing civil rights groups. Tell us about those groups and why they made a connection.
Absolutely. That's a very important point in trying to understand these coalitions and how they've come about. Because the immigrant population in most of these new destination states is, as the term suggests, it's very new, most of the immigrant rights organizations themselves are relatively recent in their development. They started in the 1990s, the 2000s. But in places like Mississippi, the immigrant rights organizers have long histories of activism. And what we have found so fascinating about the state of Mississippi is that if you look across the board at the individuals who serve in key positions in the main immigrant rights group, which is called the Mississippi Immigrant Rights Alliance, or MIRA, every single one of them is an activist from another topic, another field, another social movement. And so Bill Chandler, who's the head of the organization, cut his teeth as an activist organizing with Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta in the grape strikes in California. He helped organize Charles Evers' campaign for governor in Mississippi in the 1970s. Other leaders in the immigrant rights movement were organizers with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in the 1960s, 1970s. Chokwe Lumbumba, who was a prominent force in the pro-immigrant movement in Mississippi, grew up watching his mother organize with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Mississippi. And so these activists, many of them have known each other for years, if not decades, and they are leveraging their resources, their networks, their organizational ties to build this movement.
How much of this, Jen, is a matter of kind of personal connections and networking, and how much of it is a kind of natural affiliation? I mean, obviously, there are some correlations here. If you're talking about civil rights issues, that should be sort of an obvious connection. On the other hand, when it comes to getting those rights, it's very often siloed because you're talking about resources that come with it. So if we win the right, we may have gotten programs in our neighborhoods and in our communities. That limits the resources. That is an area where there might be conflict. So I guess my question is, how much of this is simply a natural coalition around civil rights, and how much has to do with these personal relationships that Hannah was talking about?
It's a great empirical question and one that we are engaged in now. To the best of our knowledge, it sounds like it's a little bit of both. So to the extent that networks are able to share this language of civil rights and engagement and have a shared vocabulary, that goes a long way in sort of building a movement and bringing in new people along all of these very different lines. So having Black labor organizers come in when you're talking about civil rights makes a lot more sense to them, or talking about labor rights issues makes a lot more sense to them than to just talk about it as an immigration issue. That said, I'm not sure that there's any ever natural alliance or framing, just in the same way that there's not natural conflicts. It is the case in the South, though, that most immigrants are facing a lot of the issues that many African Americans have faced historically. So they're facing heavy policing in their neighborhoods. They're facing discrimination in the education system. They're facing discrimination in voting booths. So all of those things that are traditional civil rights issues are also facing Latino communities, and that makes it a lot easier to build that kind of a tight network and vocabulary. But that's not a given, and that's not happening in all states. So what they're doing in Mississippi really successfully is highlighting those connections and making it clear that those are the areas of alliance between the two groups. And for those reasons, we need to fortify our coalition.
And you talked about labor as being an important part of this. I wonder how much of that was in play in the successful effort to organize workers at the Smithfield plant here in North Carolina. Did you take a look at that, and was that a matter of coalition building there? Because we know that the plant, we should point out, is pretty closely divided between African Americans and recent immigrants, and that was a, sort of a deliberate policy to divide the two, a sense mm-hmm. on the part of a management and the owners of Smithfield that if we could keep them apart, we can keep our labor costs low and profits high. But did it backfire?
Well, our research so far has focused on the Deep South. So we're far more familiar with and able to comment on what's happening in Mississippi, Georgia, and Alabama, though we do hope to extend our study to North Carolina and certainly plan on doing so. In Mississippi, there is a very clear collaboration between labor groups and immigrant rights groups, and that involves the civil rights movement as well. Most of the labor leaders, many of the union members in Mississippi are African American, and many of the leaders as well organized in the civil rights movement in the 60s and 70s and so on. And labor leaders were very important, instrumental in the early formation of this coalition because it was along the Gulf Coast of Mississippi where Latinos first started arriving in large numbers as the casino industry was booming, and various unions were organizing those workers. And so when the workers started experiencing discrimination, wage theft, and other issues at the hands of employers, unions were quick to jump in and understood, in part because they had this long history and experience of activism, they understood the different types of work that it would take to recruit a new population into their ranks.
And along those lines, I understand Hurricane Katrina played an important part in this. Jen, can you tell us more about that?
Yes, absolutely. So they had already been involved in terms of the organizing around casino workers. There had been a few efforts to bring ICE in to deport people who had originally been brought in to do that kind of work and then were organizing to build a union. Then when Katrina hit, you had a new wave of immigrant workers coming in to do cleanup. And very quickly, they were facing all kinds of discrimination. And this ranged from people asking for Social Security numbers and turning them away when seeking relief, to wage theft, to not providing adequate housing. And so very quickly, MIRA had formed in 2000. They jumped in. We're receiving all kinds of calls and dispatched organizers to the coast, distributed lots of flyers, engaged in lots of legal action to recover lost wages. But also a lot of the unions who had previously been organizing workers who were there got involved in those efforts as well. So the sort of infrastructure had already been developed to respond, and that was already a Black and Latino coalition. But at the same time, because they were doing this kind of work that had overwhelmingly impacted Black communities, that Latinos were coming in and doing the cleanup effort, there was a lot of public discourse around the problematic way in which the state was responding to these hardworking Latinos who are coming in and cleaning up our Black and brown communities, and we are failing them. And so that also provided a new framing moment for everyone.
But was there also kind of social tension in the other direction? Why are we hiring Latinos and not African Americans to clean up our—I mean, was that part of the conversation or not?
That's a good question. My sense is that not a whole lot. This was really difficult, dangerous work that people were not super eager to sign up for. And a lot of these employers were not providing the adequate safety protections that were needed to begin with. More so that it was Black communities who had lost homes and were more concerned with rebuilding than getting back to work.
So it's very interesting that those communities said, we're concerned about our Latino brothers who are, and sisters who are being called to this work and not the other way around.
I mean, absolutely.
That was the reaction to this. There was also an ICE raid in Laurel, Maryland, I think, that helped galvanize this.
Laurel, Mississippi. Yes, it was actually the largest ICE raid to date. And that's a very interesting and important place to look if you want to see evidence of Black, Latino cooperation on the ground. The raid occurred at a Howard Industries plant in Laurel that employed overwhelmingly Black and Latino employees. And when ICE showed up and raided the facility, they arrested and detained over 600 Latino workers. And this was quite a shock to their African-American co-workers to see the ICE officials come in and just take their co-workers and their friends away. And we've gotten some indication, and there were certainly some news stories at the time, that there were a few African-Americans in the community that didn't feel particularly strongly that immigration protections needed to be in place. But for the most part, there was quite an effort to mobilize among the black workers to mobilize to try to provide support for their arrested co-workers, and even more so to provide support for the families who were left behind when these workers were detained and deported. And so the African-American workers reached out to the Mississippi Immigrant Rights Alliance and to other pro-immigrant groups in the state to try to organize collections of donations, for example, to support the families of deported workers. And that so that gives us some evidence, certainly on the ground, that these coalitions are forming and they're running deep. It's not just at the elected official level, but that it's filtering down to the local level as well.
And there was some very specific imagery for you when House Bill 318 passed. You can tell us about that bill, but also something about that scene.
Absolutely. So House Bill 318 recently passed in North Carolina, and it was the first really significant anti-immigrant bill that's passed through the state legislature in North Carolina in quite some time. North Carolina, on the whole, has taken more of a moderate approach, at least at the state level, to immigration. There have certainly been some very punitive anti-immigrant policies and practices enacted at city and county levels. But House Bill 318, what it did was to basically prohibit cities and communities across the state from declaring themselves safe harbors for undocumented immigrants, and invalidates a lot of the ID programs that have been started by organizations around the state to help provide support and some protection for undocumented workers. And as Jen and I followed this debate quite closely, we were struck by the response from the NAACP and the traditional civil rights community. And so first, if you just as after the House passed the bill, the state NAACP website on the homepage said in big bold letters, "Our immigrant brothers and sisters are under attack." And that's a clear indication that even if these coalitions aren't as fully formed yet in North Carolina as they are in Mississippi, the groundwork, the ideological groundwork, is certainly there. And then in Greensboro, which is where Pat McCrory actually signed this bill into law, he signed the bill in front of the sheriff's office, and the counter protest and press conference happened not at one of the immigrant rights organizations in the city, of which there are a number, but in front of the International Civil Rights Museum. And so immigrant rights leaders and activists were flanked by civil rights activists in a showing of support for this particular community and opposition to this bill.
So, Jen, it's clear that these coalitions are happening, that the coalitions themselves are being constructed. Why are they effective, especially in the Deep South? How is it that coalitions of workers and African-Americans and Latinos are successful in thwarting legislation in Mississippi and Alabama?
Yeah, we think in part this is one way that the South should be set apart from other parts of the country, where you are also seeing sort of punitive bills being proposed and large changes in demographics, in that civil rights language in the South has a different kind of resonance and meaning for people across the board. It also means that there's a longer history of activism and doing that kind of groundwork and facing large-scale obstacles that minority populations here are used to organizing in some ways around these issues. And so integrating immigrant rights into the conversation isn't necessarily the most difficult leap, but also may give them the largest gains. And so we're seeing this not only in terms of sort of that proactive movement in Mississippi, but also in places like North Carolina and now Alabama, where we see immigrant coalitions starting to join as lifetime members with the NAACP or inviting African Americans onto their board so that they can build these sort of strong ties that have a deeper connection to the community and the framing.
I would also add that the Mississippi Legislative Black Caucus is an important part of this story because they've embraced immigration as a central issue, and so much so that immigration is now considered to be a black issue across the state of Mississippi. And the Black Caucus has a number of senior members. They have certainly not an insignificant amount of political power and have controlled some important committeeships in the state legislature. And so they've played a very vital role in the ability to translate this movement into actual political action.
Fascinating story. And I want to thank you both for sharing it with us today. Hannah Brown is a sociology professor at Wake Forest University. Jennifer Jones is a sociology professor at the University of Notre Dame. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Hannah and Jennifer are going to speak at 12:45 today at a panel called Language and Immigrant Rights. It's part of a Duke Law Conference, The Present and Future of Civil Rights Movements, Race and Reform in the 21st Century. Conference is sold out, but the event is live streaming, and you can find a link at our website, stateofthings.org, and you have our permission to be there instead of here in order to get onto that conference. Coming up next, the music of Lowland Hum. Stay tuned.